This is Storage Unpacked. Subscribe at storageunpacked.com.
This is Chris Evans recording a Storage Unpacked podcast, and I'm here with Mr. Martin Glasborough and Mr. Christopher Meller. Gentlemen, hey, good evening.
How
you doing, mate?
That was good evening formal, to you both.
That was very formal, wasn't it? It's nice to be formal for once. None of this elbow bashing, Chris. That was a little joke, Martin, before you joined. We were talking about elbow bashing when you're meeting people rather than shaking hands.
I'm disappointed to see that Chris isn't a shirt and tie.
He's in a shirt.
Yeah, but not a shirt and tie. No.
Well, we're not professional. Let our hair down a bit.
Now, do we call that plaid? Check like that?
I think plaid? We might.
Yeah, nobody can actually see this, of course.
I thought plaid was more woven.
Is it? Okay.
And a Scottish thing.
But you could read the weather on Countryfile with that shirt on. Because
you've now lost half our listeners, Chris.
Yeah, sorry about that.
I've looked hard at the cloth and it doesn't say anything about the weather to me.
Yeah, that was a slight diversion for anybody who is not in the UK, who doesn't even, and for the people who are in the UK who don't watch Countryfile, they do the weather forecast and the person who's normally in a suit gets allowed to wear jeans and like a check shirt to make them look more country when they're on the TV, which is ridiculous. Anyway, sorry, complete diversion. Let's go on and talk about some storage technology, shall we? So we haven't really got a title for this one. I just sort of said State of the Union, Unicorn Park 2, and I just thought it would be nice, because we haven't been together as a group and chatted for a while, just to come up with something and talk about random stuff in the industry and give everybody our opinion, like we like to do every so often.
Yeah.
How does that sound?
That sounds fun.
The same, the new, the hype.
Yes, so I've divided things into three areas. I thought it'd be interesting to talk about what's been happening. And you know, I pulled some of this list, Chris, from your wonderful posts. I looked at mine as well. I looked at some of the podcasts Martin and I had done. Just thought to try and come up with some subject matters. So the first area was just to talk about what I call the same or the incremental, the things that never change. And obviously within that, we see things like LTO tapes still keep increasing in size. 18 terabyte drives this week, Chris, you announced. Yes. You know, we still see that continuous trend forward, don't we? Nothing changes.
Yes and no. The LTO 9 was a real funny one to me because there was only a 50% capacity increase and not 100% has been the case with LTO 1, 4 to 5 to 6 to 7 and to 8. And also, it's pretty fast, LTO 9. And I found out from Quantum that LTO 8 adoption is getting skipped by customers because of the manufacturing dispute between Sony and Fujifilm last year. They had a legal ding-dong and there were no LTO 8 tape shipments for a good few months. So LTO 9 is like a stop. Well, LTO 8's turned into a stopgap with LTO 9 taking it over. And the LTO organisations also said it's great for ransomware, as it's always been. But they're pushing the air gap ransomware protection thing now to try and get more tape cartridges sold, I think.
That's interesting. I mean, yeah, it does seem to be a very quick turnaround between 8 and 9, and that's going to cause some enterprises a problem because a lot of enterprises have made strategies which they either go even numbers or odd numbers on their LTO. And if you're going to say, because of a backward read compatibility and write compatibility, you skip generations. You very rarely go from 6 to 7 to 8 to 9. So there'll be a lot of people who'll be sitting on 6 who'll be thinking, oh, we're going to go to 8 because we've got backward compatibility. We won't go to 7, but going to 9 causes them a problem because they're going to have a load of tapes which can't be written, and that will mess up your number of tape drives you have in a system, also the number of tapes which you can't. You're going to have to do a migration. You can't write to them, so you're going to have to start migrating. So that's, although we may look at 8 and say it's a bit of a stopgap, I still think you're going to find quite a lot of enterprises who will go to 8 because it's the way they do their refreshes.
I wonder who decided to bring LTO 9 forward. And also to drop the doubling of capacity for the LTO 9 and just have a 50% capacity increase. They're apparently going to go back to a doubling increase for 9 to 10, 10 to 11, and 11 to 12. So I'm thinking this looks to be a bit of a quick move by the LTO providers, HPE, Quantum, and IBM. I can't think of anybody else who's really bothered about this.
It's not always doubled, though. There have been smaller skips. There have been smaller leaps in the past. Sometimes it happens, and sometimes it's a technology change. It's something which just happens, and they're not quite ready. If you look for five, so 5 to 6 wasn't a doubling. 5 to 6 was 1.5 to 2.5.
Ah,
so
okay.
It has happened before. So that this sort of 1.5, 1.5 times increase as opposed to a doubling, it does happen.
Can I just say it's amazing to think that even taking that aside, they've been pretty consistent and every generation increasing this since they first started. So as a technology, it is amazing to see how much they've created, not linearly, but certainly very consistently created that increase year on year or release on release.
Well, if you look at the roadmap at the moment, so I mean, let's go back. LTO 6 to 7 was 2.5 terabyte raw, which is all we're really interested in a lot of the time. We talk about tape against 7, which was a 6 terabyte. But if you look at the roadmap between 9 to 10 is a massive leap. 9 is a native of 18 terabytes, mm-hmm. which is huge. If you think of a single point of failure, domain, you lose a tape, you lose 18 terabytes as the data. But LTO 10 is 48 terabytes.
Well, it's 36 now.
Is it 36?
Yeah.
We're saying 36? Well, I've got a map in front of me which gives me 48, so it might be wrong.
But I think that's the old map.
It's the old map. Okay, so I obviously changed it. Well, at one point, it was showing 18 to 48. But we do see these things happen. So
it's still a doubling, though, if it goes to 36, isn't it? It's still doubled.
We're at the stage where, 18 terabytes, both Chris's. We can remember that was a reasonable size storage array.
Yes.
Right? You're potentially talking about backing up a storage array onto a single tape. But your failure domain, if you lose that tape, anybody who's mad enough to back up and is not taking a second copy, because that's going to be up, that's horrible. It's a horrible amount of whole data to lose on your system.
Well, 3480 Model 1, wasn't that 200 megabytes?
Yeah, about that. I mean, LTO 1 was 100 gigabytes.
Yeah, and go back, 10 years before, and you were talking about, I think, 200 megabytes for a 3480, the first generation. Then they doubled it to 400. Then they brought IDRC out, which was the compression on the drive. And then they brought out 3490, which obviously increased it again by doubling the number of tracks. But we were talking megabytes. Now, then we started talking gigabytes in the first stage, and now we're talking terabytes worth of data on a single cartridge. It's quite amazing.
I remember going from 4 to 5 and suddenly realizing that you had 1.5 terabytes on a tape drive, and that seemed to be an awful lot of data to have on a tape drive.
You mentioned the number 18, Martin, there, and obviously you mentioned in a post, Chris, the idea of 18 terabyte hard drives.
Seagate has introduced an 18 terabyte conventionally recorded drive, and Western Digital have an 18 terabyte shingled magnetic recording drive. And Seagate say they'll bring out a 20 terabyte HAMR drive by the end of the year. I dare say Western Digital will try and hit a 20 terabyte mark by the end of the year as well.
So if you were listening to the podcast last week, which I'm sure you were, Chris, obviously, you would have heard that Phil Bullinger said 24 in his, when he was counting up the different sizes, he was like, 16, 18, and he said 24 coming soon. Now, I don't think he was giving away any confidences there. I think he was just, telling us where he saw the progression going, but it clearly can't be far before we start seeing 24 terabyte drives.
That'll be a shingled one, I should think, from Western Digital, which means it needs to be host managed, which means you need some software in there to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's still incredible to think how they've done that. I mean, one of the things that Phil pointed out was obviously they've put more platters in, they've used helium so they can squeeze them in a bit more, make them thinner. But just as a technology, it's incredible to see the two of those are just leap up year after year after year.
Yeah, but if we put this back to tape again, because it's one of my favourite things to start to talk about, is actually but the density on the tape is much lower than the disc. They have a lot further to go if they started getting down to disc densities, which they won't. You're talking about huge tapes if they really wanted to. They'd have to change how their heads and things read, but there's a lot of space to go in the tape for sheer size.
There's something that gets me about tape and its density. A tape reel goes through the drive and it bends. It bends a lot. It's pulled out from the start reel, bends through the drive at high speed and then is wrapped around another target reel with layers of tape being smacking on it all the time. Well, if you did that to disk drive platter, which is just spinning rigidly in a controlled space with a controlled gas around it, Seagate and Western Digital and Toshiba would go potty. They'd think you're crazy. They'd think you wanted to destroy the drive or something. So I just wonder how tape manages to have such longevity when the actual medium is abused by going through the drive mechanism.
It gets really abused. I've seen tapes read which you've got creases in, where the leader pin's dropped and you've had to rewind it, you tighten it up and it still manages to recover the data. The error correction on tape is phenomenal. They do some very spectacular things. It's relatively easy to destroy tape. You take a pair of scissors to it, but if it gets creased, most of the time you'll get one read out of it. You'll get enough reads out of it to actually get your data off. Then you might want to throw that tape away. But yeah, I mean, it is incredible what they do with tape. At some point, Chris, we should probably find somebody to come and talk to us about tape and what they do with it.
I think so. I think there'd be an interesting discussion, especially what you just said there, Chris. I hadn't really thought of the fact that you're right. You know, we fly the read head rewrite head on a hard drive above the surface. It doesn't touch it. And if it did touch it, it would damage it, it would wreck it. And that would be the end of it. But tape does seem to withstand an awful lot more mistreatment and still lasts, you know, potentially 30 years as well.
Tape drives have stopped being read in the US states affected by forest fires because the air quality is so bad. They don't want to expose a tape cartridge to the air.
Ooh.
Oh, I know some funny stories about that, about way back in my career when I used to work for Lloyd's Bank. There was a data center in Peterborough, and
that was one of their main ones, wasn't it?
Yeah. And there was a load of failures on tapes. And the reason that they decided it was they were far too close to a local crematorium and they thought the dust was getting into the system and actually was causing tape errors.
Crematorium dust is death to tapes.
So, Chris, you live in South London, don't you? I did some work on a data centre based in Croydon quite a few years ago.
And you survived.
Deutsche Bank and another bank, Rabobank, were based there. But then I was helped doing the build out of the equipment. And we came out one day and it was right next to the local dump, this particular location, very nice. We came out one day and we walked out to go and get something to eat, came back, and they built these big rocks, which they covered with like chicken wire. And they'd done like this lovely sort of bluey, fluorescent-y cover to it. And we thought, wow, that's really impressive. I walked up to have a look at it and realized it was bits of shredded clothes and carpet and stuff that had been blown away from the dump and caught on the chicken wire. But because it all laid out, it looked really quite pretty. But when you got it close, you thought, oh dear, that's going to be hitting the filters of our air conditioning on the top of our data center, I'm sure. That's not going to be good for it. So same scenario. It's amazing, isn't it? Anyway, moving on. Let's keep going. Let's talk about Dell EMC decided to build yet another storage platform. Not content with having brought out a new platform for the mid-range. There's now a new object storage platform potentially touted, Chris.
This is very, very peculiar. And rumour has it, there's another vendor going to be bringing out a proprietary, well, another object storage platform in the next few days, which I can't say a word about. But why on earth do we need more object storage platforms?
We haven't got enough, surely. You know,
we haven't got it. EMC and Dell have a thing about backward compatibility, and yet they throw different object storage software into the pond again and again and again. Centera, Atmos, Viper had its storage platform, then ECS, and now we've got this other thing. I'm a little bit bewildered, frankly.
I don't understand the logic behind continuing to add stuff to the portfolio when you're not consolidating or you're not doing something to try and rationalize it more effectively. Now, okay, if they've decided they're saying ECS isn't good enough, we're going to throw it away, we're starting again, I could sort of see that. But, you know, it's really confusing. And I think in the object storage market, especially, where you've got a lot of data that's long-term retained and you're going to have to go through potentially some quite big migrations of petabytes and petabytes of data, any sort of change is going to be a bit of a nightmare.
I think they're throwing things at walls to see what sticks. I think this is it. I don't think they've ever really managed to produce an object platform which was really stuck. Centeras has hung around, and Centera APIs have hung around because there are some very large banks, especially, and some pharmaceuticals who are using it for their archive and over regulatory reasons why they have to hang around. But I don't think the adoption of object would certainly in a private data center has been anything like they expected. And they just keep trying until they find something which sticks.
There's the Isilon system, the new PowerScale, which also has object storage capability. And that's not ECS. And I haven't had it confirmed that object scale is the same as PowerScale's object facility.
Well, that's an interesting thing. Yeah, so Isilon's had object storage capability for quite some time. And there's been a lot of discussions about with Dell EMC about whether they should. But at the end of the day, nobody really cares. All anybody really wants, and if anybody's listening, all developers want and all anybody wants is a high level of S3 compatibility. That's all you want. You don't want to write your code for anything else.
I think this part of the market is interesting because at the end of the day, it does raise the question about how many large organizations want just object stores and how many of them have just said, you know what, we'll just stick it in a file system because actually it's easier to access, it's easier to get to. And they just, even now, still aren't that bothered about making the leap to changing their software unless they've got a good reason to. And when they do, like you said, Martin, they want to go down the S3 route. It just makes me think that this is just a harder market than people give it credit for.
Well, it is. And certainly when you start talking about third-party applications they quite like dealing with file because they understand how file works. File is file. They're also, if you want object, that's all they're going to be interested in. They're just going to be interested in S3. And that's all you're going to want as a customer because you buy application X from vendor X, application Y from vendor Y, and they're both talking to the same object store. You want that. You don't want vendor Y talking a completely different object protocol or a slightly different object protocol to X because that's going to damage your workflows, your data flows. So don't introduce another protocol. Don't introduce another API. I'm afraid you're all going to have to suck it up and say, "Oh, Amazon have got this. We're just going to have to play catch up with Amazon on this," or we stick to file.
NetApp started saying that Storage Grid, one of the roles for that object storage product, is to provide a backup and archive facility for all flash on tap arrays. So I wonder whether Dell EMC are thinking the same thing about wanting to have an object storage facility that could be a backup or an archive for their all flash arrays.
Gosh, that just adds more confusion about whether or what's the data mover in there, what's the backup software, how are you going to store that data in what format so you can move it around. You're going to be locked into the NetApp platform or the EMC platform if it's not in some sort of self-describing format. The implications of doing that are pretty horrible if you're an end user.
Yeah, I can see why they might try and do it, but ultimately I just don't see end users playing or buying that. They don't want this. They don't want this type coupling, and you don't want a type coupling. I mean, all kinds of reasons. Lock-in's not just the only thing. You do it for data portability, transportability. You might have a heterogeneous environment where you do want to be able to pull stuff in and out. I don't see why you'd want to lock these things in so tightly. Certainly, maybe for backup, certainly not for archive.
There you go. So, well, you know, given another 12 months, there'll be another platform they'll be bringing out. What's the next one going to be? You know, what do we not have a new one of recently? We've had object, we've had mid-range. We do something else? Or are they just going to create a brand new category altogether?
I suspect so. I think I'd love to.
Kubernetes-type storage. We'll have a specific protocol for containers, possibly.
Kubernetes. Drink. We're going to allow it. You mentioned we should have had a buzzword bingo, shouldn't we, today? We should do that, actually, next time round, and have a little buzzword bingo card, and everybody can cross out all the buzzwords that we say as we go through it and whether we mention the right things. And speaking of which, opt-in technology. Yeah, seems to be getting there slowly but surely, but it really is slow. But you highlighted that Jim Handy had done some research that indicated that he thought Intel might be making a profit off that technology.
Yes, he'd done some analysis of Intel's figures for its non-volatile memory solutions group and found out that it was making far lower losses than before. So Optane might even be profitable. One thing I had a, a, a late realization about Optane, which is perhaps an idiot realizing something slowly. But in the memory storage hierarchy, there's memory, and then there are these various storage drives, SSDs, disk drives, tape, and so forth. And it struck me, which was blindingly obvious, that memory is accessed by load store instructions, and storage devices are accessed through a storage stack with read and write or gets and puts and so forth. So they're talking about blocks of data rather than individual bits and bytes. So along comes Optane, and it's both memory and both storage, or rather, Intel made it both memory and both storage. Well, why? I guess because it wasn't good enough as a cheaper form of memory, and it wasn't quite fast enough to be a better form of storage. I'm grasping straws here. And then, as well as having memory mode and storage mode for Optane, Intel gave it a variety of modes inside the memory mode, some of which were persistent and some of which, amazingly, were not. So it actually seems to me to be 5 or 6 different devices using the same products, using the same technology. In which case, no wonder adoption has been hard, because people have got to decide which particular mode of Optane they're actually going to optimize their software for. It's a peculiar subject altogether.
And of course, it's tied to a particular chipset, the Xeon Scalable processors, second generation, I think. So yeah. You can't just plug and play into any old chassis. You can't use it with AMD, for example. So all of the new AMD processors are not going to be or compatible ARM. With it. Or, and you won't be able to use it with ARM or anything like that. So in some respects, I can see what you mean, Chris. And I think maybe they created the technology and thought, wow, this is brilliant, but we could do more with it. But they didn't really know what the best route to go was. So they thought, well, let's try and make it fit all the different use cases. And sometimes by fitting all the use cases, you make things more complex to understand.
That certainly seems to have been the case for me. And with Intel now separating from Micron in manufacturing Optane, then Micron have got the opportunity to do its own thing with the Optane, with the 3D XPoint technology, I should say. And so I see AMD, ARM, and the power CPUs being prime targets for Micron to try and spread the market.
Yeah, I would have thought so. Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a bit of a gap. Certainly, AMD are making big roads into Intel server market and making big inroads into that space. But what they do miss is an Optane-like device. Not that very many people are using them at the moment. It's not that common. But as these things become better understood, there will be a demand for them. And it may be just perfect for Micron. And certainly with NVIDIA now picking at ARM as well. NVIDIA have made chipsets in the past as well. So, yeah, this could be perfect timing, and we could see a standard. And it would be funny if Intel did all the work and then a standard comes out which becomes cross-platform, and then it won't be a case that AMD and ARM aren't compatible with Optane, Intel aren't compatible with a standard, and then they'll end up backporting and having to think about how they actually adopt the standard. Wouldn't be the first time it's happened.
It's an interesting thought, though, that we could see AMD going with Micron and that being the relationship in that side of things, because Micron have got QLC as well. So they've got QLC, they would have the 3D Crosspoint, and then if they had it aligned to an architecture, they've effectively got exactly what Intel's got, and then they're competing directly, aren't they? That I think that could be a really interesting approach if that's what happens.
Yeah, I think it will be interesting to see what happens in this space now. I mean, Intel have a world of problems at the moment, and this just seems to add to them.
There are other storage class memory candidates in the wings as well. Samsung, for instance. And then the various phase change memories muttering around through some of the other SSD NAND makers. Spin transfer talk memory. But I don't see any of them really having as much impetus behind them as Optane. And yet Optane is peculiarly limited, crippled, delayed, held up by the difficulty of software using it and by Intel's wish to keep it tied to the x86 architecture so it helps sell those processors rather than AMD's.
I would say it's not limited in terms of its ability to be used because the operating systems have supported it for a while. So that's been in the kernel for quite a while for Linux. Mm-hmm. And I think Windows has had it as DAX for quite a while as well. So that has been there. and it could definitely be used. But the challenge is the chipset, and there's the fact that you're upgrading all of your equipment in order to use it. And that, to me, I think is probably the biggest challenge. You know, there's a big cost in doing that. It's like people who say, well, why have we never moved away from Fibre Channel and we've not gone to all Ethernet? It's because people get heavily invested in something, and moving on from that heavy investment in something to something else in the data center becomes a rip and replace, which costs you a fortune. So if you're going to replace your servers, you might incrementally decide to put Optane in, but you're going to have a good use case. If you remember the very early days of Flash in the enterprise, I remember sitting in discussions where we'd got some EMC arrays and we were looking at putting in some flash drives into those boxes. And we were sat with the DBAs going, well, what could you do with this? And they're like, well, we could use it, but it would be hard because we can't put all of our data onto that one LUN that you give us because it'd be too expensive. And then we'd have to carve a bit off. And, you know, there wasn't the tiering or the automated tiering or anything like that. So initially the adoption was quite limited simply because trying to get it into an application and use it effectively and not waste a lot of it was hard. And maybe that's been part of Intel's problem with Optane, that, you know, you need to wait for that refresh cycle on your servers to really kick in.
I think it'd be interesting to see an Optane or an Optane this starting to appear in consumer space on the desktop. When I say the desktop, I don't actually really mean the desktop. I think if AMD can get a story together with something like Micron, think 5-6 years time, next gen consoles with something like Optane in, which giving them a lot of extra memory to hold in big 4K textures to move around, something like that. Because AMD at the moment have a console space tied up, so this is where you could see something like that happen.
Gaming workstations too, maybe.
Gaming workstation, but actually, I'm just thinking actually your consoles. I mean, DRAM's expensive. DRAM's expensive and its power expensive. If you look at the size of the Lakers consoles, they're big. They've got a lot of it's about temperature, cooling. But if you can actually keep the temperatures down, and one of the things which gives off the most heat as well as CPUs is memory. If Optane or a similar technology is better heat efficiency, it has a real use in that consumer space.
That would be amazing if that happened.
But we've seen it with Flash. We've seen it with we've seen where the big driver of Flash has been consumer. I mean, that's what's driven it. Everybody expects it in their laptops. Now we're seeing it going into consoles. But do we see something similar again with this type of technology? The adoption within the enterprise has been slower than expected. But if somebody can work out how to use it in a consumer space, we may find it becomes something which is a lot more accepted. Developers begin to expect it in their workstations or whatever they're developing for. But then you see it back up into the enterprise space.
It's a good story.
Yeah. Let's move on. We'll park that one and see what, you know, come back in the future and have a look at that. The last one on this section really was just to point out that Nutanix is still not making a profit, has borrowing a load more money, although it's classed as an investment, air quotes. And of course, we're seeing a change of CEO. And I wonder whether the CEO leaving is a combination of him just being tired of having put so much effort into getting the company where it is, or whether it was related to the investment. You know, let's have a new face at the front of the company.
That was exactly the question I thought to myself when you suggested this as a topic, Chris. Was Dheeraj's departure the price paid for the new money?
It could be easy to be negative about it, but sometimes when you get to this point and you've had somebody who's good at getting a company established and bringing it up to a certain point, you need somebody else to come in along behind them who's good at driving the efficiency of the business, driving the revenue, and getting it to a profitable position. And maybe that's what they've decided, that if we're going to give you the money to get to that place, we need a head leading the company who's got that ability to do that. And it was maybe an opportunity for, you know, two birds with one stone, if you know what I mean.
So that would be the classic startup founding CEO switching over to a more commercial CEO. And the founding CEO generally switches over to a CTO or an architectural or a strategy role. And I think what Dheeraj has done with Nutanix, he's been there for so long, he's built the company up so great that as a founding CEO, he must be one of the best ones ever. And they said they're specifically looking for a new CEO outside the company rather than from inside the existing management structure. Hey, Tarkan, you better leave the company, apply for the CEO job.
Yeah, you'll have to resign to come back. Gosh, can you imagine? Yeah, that'd be interesting, wouldn't it? Or not. Okay, right. I'm going to keep us moving. So let's move on and talk about the emerging now. I've only got a couple of things in this one, but I think there are a couple. It's really hitting on a couple of aspects of the industry that might be interesting, might not be. And the first one is just this idea that Pure Storage has bought Portworx, and whether and what that really means for, and not for Pure, obviously, because you know they're an established company. Move on from that, but you can talk about that if you want. But more importantly, does this add some sort of credibility to the use of Kubernetes storage, that shall we call it? What do we think about that?
Now, what is Kubernetes storage?
I know, I used it. I should have put air quotes in it, shouldn't I? I made an expression Kubernetes storage. I guess storage for container environments, potentially built out of containers.
Storage for container environments that have been orchestrated by Kubernetes.
No, well, yes, exactly. They're built on container environments. So they're a distributed storage platform within the container ecosystem itself already.
I think one of the things that struck me about Pure buying Portworx is that NetApp could have decided to buy Portworx. In fact, they did buy a storage provider, a cloud-native storage provider in the first case, Talon, I think it was, or something like that, but then canned it. And develop the they're developing their own software themselves with Project Astra. So they're thinking it must be clearly worthwhile to do this. This is going to be an absolutely necessary piece of technology.
Who's developing Project Astra internally?
NetApp.
NetApp. Know who within NetApp?
Was that a hidden question? Is it the ONTAP group?
It's Eric. Is it Eric Han?
Eric Han, yes. Who's an ex-Portworx guy?
Exactly. So have they just brought the person with the skills and the knowledge over to NetApp to help them develop their own equivalent product?
Yeah, buy the person, not the company. It's cheaper than spending $300 million or whatever Portworx was bought for. Just buy the person. Because if he got a $300 million deal, he's done very well. But
single person acquihire.
Yeah.
Well, but I guess at the end of the day, you know, if you look at the recent acquisitions of NetApp, they've acquired, you know, StackPoint Cloud they bought, but they sort of shut that through the head, didn't they? They sort of decided that they didn't really want to get into the orchestration business. But they bought Spot, they bought, what are the other two they bought just recently? Somebody help me out. I can't
Cloud
remember.
Jumper?
Now. Cloud Jumper, yeah, for VDI, which I'm still trying to get my head around.
Yes, that was kind of weird. NetApp is now in the VDI space.
Yeah, and Talon, which is the other one. So they bought a few, let's call it DevOpsy, you know, cloud-type companies. So they've probably got the skills within the company to develop software to make this work. They probably need somebody with a vision to work out exactly how it should all plug together. And I'm guessing that's what they've got Eric for.
Yes. Yeah, it
could be. But that doesn't answer the question as to whether we think this is an area where we think there's, you know, money to be made, that the enterprise is going to pick it up and use it.
Okay, so I have some concerns about Kubernetes in general. I think we both do, Chris. We've both played with it. We think it's unbelievably complex at times and still doesn't feel enterprise ready. Recently, somebody put up a poster from the Cloud Native Foundation of all the projects and the umbrella, and certainly stuff which is falling under things like Kubernetes. The poster is huge. All which is going through my mind at the moment is OpenStack. OpenStack was going to be the next big thing. And there were a lot of people forming OpenStack startups to do storage and do things around there. I'm beginning to wonder, is this where we're heading? Is it just like the next great hope, but in startups are going to pour money into it, but actually it's too complicated and nobody ever does anything with it? Although there would be a few big companies which do things with it, people like Walmart and things like that who have massive OpenStack implementations, but generally, it's not a market. VCs are going to pour money into it because they're looking for the next big thing, but it's not going to be the next big thing because it's just too complicated and too fragmented at the moment.
Did OpenStack, did any enterprises actually withdraw from OpenStack, or did it just kind of plateau and then tail away?
It's plateaued. It's still there. I know plenty of places who have had OpenStack implementations who are now beginning to decommission and move away. So big enterprises are beginning to move away from it. They're either looking at doing it in public cloud, or interestingly enough, a lot of people are doing stuff with VMware and vSphere. They've decided actually, you know what, the simplicity of that lock-in is actually worth it when you compare it to the complexity of OpenStack. And I know VMware are doing stuff with Kubernetes, with Tanzu. Maybe that's where enterprises will go with Kubernetes. Those enterprises who, most enterprises are risk averse, and they don't want to be playing with these massive open source ecosystems. They want a very controlled set. And they'll be boring, and they'll buy stuff from their established vendors. So maybe Pure by Portworx is quite sensible. They're becoming an established vendor, and then we say, you know what, you're doing all this Kubernetes stuff. We've got something to sell you. You don't actually have to do a deal with this company down the street. There's some credibility here. You've got the weight of Pure behind us. The same way Dell would EMC do, NetApp. All of that. Actually, that's a funny thing. I want to bring us back to NetApp. Did you know that NetApp have rebranded?
Yes. They've gone from Pantone 300 Blue to Black. And a VP of brand and image said this was incredibly cool. And I nearly fell about laughing when I read that.
It is one of the funnier ones. I asked them, when they told me, I said, oh, you're calling yourself NetApps now.
You're not allowed to call them NetApps, Martin. That gets us into trouble.
So they obviously spent a lot of money rebranding, so they're now Black, so they're going emo. There you go.
I mean, gosh, I did see it. I did see the branding, and I have watched a couple of the videos. And, you know, they're talking about this specialist thing and not this generalist. But to have gone literally from saying, well, we've got this blue colour one to now this black colour one, didn't really seem like it was a radical rebranding of their platform. All it seemed to say to me was, well, it means it's much easier to integrate the color scheme into different website designs, because now we haven't got to match things with Pantone 300. We can match it with anything because it's black, you know.
Sorry to derail the conversation.
No further comment on that one, Martin.
It just amused me. It's like rebranding by changing the color of the logo. I thought it was fantastic.
It must have been done similarly in other ways. It's a bit like the Golden Arcs and the Golden Arches, if you know Coming to America. Okay, all right. So, yeah, we're sort of out on the... We're undecided as to whether we think Kubernetes storage is likely to go anywhere, but we'll see. How about the idea of storage on a stick? Well, it's not really a stick, is it? It's a storage on a NIC, I suppose, or storage on an HBA, as provided by Nebulon. What do we think about that as an idea?
Shall I wade in?
Go on then. Yes, absolutely.
Well, I have a doubt that people buy a storage array because it's better managed than somebody else's storage array. I'm sure that's a factor. I'm sure people buy a storage array because it's better at storage than somebody else's array. And I can't see Nebulon saying that their storage array is better than anybody else's storage array. They say it's better because it's cloud defined. Well, okay, so your management plane is in the cloud, but what about the storage? Yeah, I just don't get it. It's just another proprietary controller, really. What's different about it? What does it actually do? Do you get your blocks faster or what?
Well, I suppose they're locally connected, so potentially you could read as fast as a local device, but then I'm not sure that there are many applications that makes a difference to, really, these days.
Very few.
Yeah. I guess I looked at it and thought, okay, could be an interesting concept if you were building out an OpenStack or a container farm or a massive VMware farm, where basically you just wanted to put in generic servers and build like an HCI model, but you wanted to have it integrated into the box. And you didn't want to pay the overhead and the tax of having a third or a quarter or a fifth of your server being carved out and given away to the storage controller, if you like. Because obviously you'd be paying by the license for cores, so you'd be not be able to put as many VMs on there. You would lose some capacity. And when you're paying for your things like your VMware license by cores, or if your databases and other things, there might be a marginal saving in pushing the storage into a controller. But outside of that, I'm not sure I see a significantly large benefit for most customers.
I'm just chuckling with his idea that Chris thinks people buy storage because it's better than somebody else's storage.
Don't destroy my illusions.
You obviously didn't listen to our buying discussion the other week, where we just talked about how it's all about what deal you can do, or how aggressive Martin's been with his storage supplier, or how nice you've been to them, Martin. Actually,
it's an amusing thought. Most enterprises will stick with a vendor they've got unless that vendor's really upset them somehow. Very rarely we do, because the cost of doing a tech refresh is huge. So the incumbent has to have done something horribly wrong, or the new vendor must have some amazing story to tell. And considering we run a podcast on enterprise storage, most enterprise storage is much of a muchness. It's not, there's not that much new. This is why at times when we talk about things like storage on a NIC or a HBA, that's why we struggle, because we don't really see that it is particularly new, or we don't really wonder what it's really bringing to the party. But I tell you what, Chris, very rarely does any enterprise buy storage from another vendor because they think it's better.
I'll just give you a little bit of a qualifier on that one. There was a large UK bank that I was doing some work for about 10 or 15 years ago, and they were going to go down the route of buying their storage from one particular vendor that we'd recommended. And they chose and went a different route to another vendor because they had an outstanding court case with that vendor, and they agreed to wipe off something like $100 million court case on something else if they bought storage from them. I'm not going to mention any names, but basically it was nothing to do with the technology whatsoever. It was all to do with another deal higher up. And I think
Well, I'm going to try and recover some ground here. I don't. When I say better, what do I mean by better? Technology surely got to have a role in there somewhere. So, okay, deal parameters matter a lot. But if somebody can farm out files to accessing servers five times faster than some other supplier can farm out files to accessing servers, then great. You'll have a really good chance of winning that sale.
I think that's true. If you care about that, if that's relevant to your business, if you know if that makes a difference to you.
Well, let's say you're worried about the number of VMs you can run in servers, and those VMs are IO limited. So if you can pump more data to them faster, you can get more VMs in the servers. Surely makes sense.
If you can justify that, yeah, absolutely, I would agree. And I'm sure, you know, people make those sort of decisions all the time, don't they? They look at a different vendor and say, they can give me a different cost profile, or, you know, that it's easier to manage. But I would agree with Martin and say that making that change tends to be a big step for somebody to make. And if you're at any sort of size and volume, making that change is really a big decision to make. And you might run dual vendor for a little while, you might then eventually move, but there's a big learning curve to see what happens when it doesn't work properly, whether the vendor's reliable in terms of servicing and maintenance, whether they're consistent in terms of giving you that cost price, you know, quarter after quarter, month after month. I think there's a lot of inertia there built into the whole thing, depending on how big you are.
But not enough to stop people like Pure starting up and getting to where they are today, or Nutanix starting up and getting where it is today, or even NetApp back in the day. Right. So yes, it's difficult. It's a nice filter making sure that your technology is very, very good to get through that inertia.
And NetApp back in the day, Chris, were pretty unique. They were, and because when NetApp came along, you didn't have very much choice about who you'd build, who you could buy to do file. So NetApp actually fine. So it's whether something else can come along which people really, really want. And I think that's what a lot of people in the object space thought. They could be another NetApp because people really, really wanted it. But it turns out they really, really didn't want it on premises. Certainly not at the adoption rate that people thought it was going to happen. Yeah, Pure's interesting. Pure actually started up at a time when there was probably the most distant attraction with the big enterprise vendors. Their timing was pretty much perfect, I think. And they were very aggressive. And you have to be very, very aggressive. And it was very interesting to see who they targeted and who they went off after. And then you've been Nutanix. But Nutanix, we're talking about Nutanix still not making a profit.
Or Pure, technically.
Okay, yeah. They're still
really,
still
really close, but they're still not quite there.
But they're still not making any money out of this. So they may be buying business, or their costs may be still too high. Their internal costs, their cost of sales.
Let me interrupt. I just had a phone call from Charlie Giancarlo. He's saying he's listening to this podcast, and by golly, you're right. He's closing down Pure Storage right now and returning the money back to the VCs.
Well, he ought to.
He ought.
But he can't, though, because he spent most of it.
Yeah, that is a bit of a challenge, isn't it? You know, when you've spent the money.
Perhaps they're too big to fail now.
Well, do you know, here's the thing to think about. What percentage of the things like the IDC and the, you know, those trackers, do they show up as, Chris? They barely hit that, like, 4-5%, don't they?
But Pure is third or fourth in the all-flash array converts, all-flash array market share.
In all-flash, but in the general market, they're only, like, maybe 4-5%.
Yes.
Yeah. And what does that say after 10 years of being in business, 11 years of 8 years of having product in the market?
It takes a while to build a business.
It takes a long time to build, to build that business. And I think, you know, there's the reflection back on what we just said about inertia of changing your technology. Lots of people get very comfortable with it. And if you're a big environment, you're not going to necessarily sweep the floor in one fell swoop. You have to take time. Maybe you put it in somewhere and it grows. So it's a tricky, tricky thing to do.
And it's difficult, but Pure came along and I give it very looked very easy to manage, very simple, interesting buy model. And as maybe some of the enterprises started to show a little bit of interest in that, it's amazing how quickly those big enterprise vendors said, you know what, we can do the same model. We can simplify our management tools. And that's always is getting that at getting up to speed quickly enough that you can properly displace vendors. But yeah, they may have called some of the big vendors some pain, and they may still be getting wins, but are they getting those wins quickly enough to turn themselves into the next NetApp to really become a giant? And I would go back to say, I don't think they were special enough. NetApp turned up. They turned up with something which people wanted, and that was file. And then NetApp actually were very fortunate. Really, really fortunate. Something else came along. VMware came along. And really interesting the way VMware and EMC interacted. When EMC bought VMware, EMC was so hands-off and was so nervous about VMware being seen to be so closely tied to the mothership. You'd rarely see a VMware salesman with an EMC salesman. You saw them with a NetApp salesman all the time. So Pure need to find something which they can really tie themselves and actually being seen lockstep with a different technology. Maybe containers will be it, but that's what they needed. VMware did NetApp a massive favor, and Pure haven't got that at the moment.
This strikes a thought. Would NVIDIA treat ARM in the same way as Dell and EMC treat VMware?
Everybody hopes they will, because that's ARM's value as Silicon's Switzerland. They're neutral. They'll sell their blueprints. They'll sell their designs to anybody. That may be problematic for NVIDIA with selling those designs and those developments to China, but then NVIDIA being a massive US company. But it'd be very interesting to see how that goes.
But that doesn't really answer the question of whether we think Nebulons as a technology is something that's going to see a big adoption. But I think probably it gives you an idea that in order to be successful, they need that sea change perhaps in the industry, like you just said, Martin, with that we saw for NetApp. And if they don't get that, it just becomes another piece of technology you can choose from in the data center.
I would say Nebulon, it's very early days. Very, very early days. They've got some big names involved. And you can't discount any of them, but it's still it's a relatively small, well-funded startup. But really, seeing I'm not quite sure how they position themselves in the market. I've not seen anything which said made me think, oh yeah, I know exactly what I'd do with that. I know exactly how I'd replace my existing estate with that. I know where it fits. At the moment, it's nebulous. Exactly, Chris.
I like what you did there, Chris. Play on words.
Oh, I can see. Vast Data. It's just another storage array supplier-ish, except it uses QLC flash, and it's got clever software. StorOne is just another storage array supplier, except it uses QLC flash. Infinidat is just another storage array supplier, except it uses memory caching on top of disk drives. What's Nebulon's thing? What's Nebulon's storage thing, apart from having a cloud management aspect to it? This is where I'm puzzled. So, okay, it has this proprietary controller architecture with smart HBAs and ASICs and so on and so forth. But, sorry, so what? What does it actually give you in terms of storage performance?
So that's a really interesting question, because on the one hand, if you look at, say where Vast are or where Pure were when they first came out, there was definitely that original differentiator, which they built on, and Pure definitely built on it, and they incorporated NVMe quite early on, and then they built it so that you could replace the components quite easily. So they they did have a good story from that perspective, even though they were just a dual controller storage array. Fair enough. Fast have definitely got an interesting angle. Still One have got an interesting angle. Small at this stage, but you know, they've got the software built in there that's doing stuff. The Nebulon one is interesting because it's actually probably not going to be as... Oh, let's say that again because that's a bit unfair. But I think perhaps we need to see a second generation or a third generation of the technology to see it be successful. So, for example, it currently has to take extra power because it uses more power than a single PCIe slot. So it has to take power from the GPU slot. Well, that means you now need a server with a GPU slot in it that can power it. The drives don't plug into the PCI infrastructure, so it's not NVMe drives plugging into it. You have to have a connector on the SAS drives that plugs into the Nebulon card. So again, it's a different. It's not, you know, what you'd think it might be. Now the next generation could, for example, reduce the power. It could go in a standard slot. It could do everything across PCIe. You could put it in a standard server and not need all the extra connectors and all those other things. And then all of a sudden you could look at it and go, oh, wow, okay, this turns a standard server into something much more flexible. And I can deploy it into the stuff I'm buying on the cheap from Supermicro, from everybody. But at the moment, it's not like that. So I wonder whether we're going to need to see a second or third generation before they get to that point.
Do you think it might compete with Fungible?
I don't really know.
Data processing unit. It's specialized hardware for managing storage and east-west interactions inside data centers.
I mean, eventually, I suppose it could be. That could be their goal, is to add other features onto the card and become something a bit like the computational storage type stuff. But again, I think then that becomes, that's a whole area which, do you know what, we talk for 55 minutes, whether we want to continue talking about that now. But at the end of the day, that's quite a big step forward, isn't it, to move from delivering straightforward storage services to delivering something that's more like an analytics on the actual data.
I was going to say, one of the key things in Nebulon, though, because it's on a card which goes into servers, they need to be signing some agreements with some server vendors. Enterprises don't like having servers delivered and then having to put a card in afterwards. So they either need to be signing deals with server vendors or with big SIs.
And I think that's their model. I think that is their model, Martin. Yeah. I think the model is to go to HPE and people and just, it's a SKU and you just order it with the card in.
Yeah.
They have a deal with HPE. I'm sure Fujitsu will fall down and follow. Yeah. I think Lenovo will probably follow.
Yeah, but HPE will have a deal with everybody.
I doubt it. IBM?
IBM don't make servers.
Nope.
Not anymore.
They all the power. But then...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You might as well class that
Cisco,
as like the
mainframe. Maybe.
Do they make servers?
Oracle.
Well, yeah.
The unknown conservative.
I was thinking there's got to be a joke somewhere there about Oracle and videos and TikTok or something, but I can't.
Yeah, TikTok. And Nebulon's going to be the power behind TikTok on Oracle Cloud. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you know what? I think we might have reached the point where we might want to say that's probably all we talk for today.
Yeah.
Before we get ourselves into some serious trouble with somebody. So, well, for the next time, we'll save... There's a few things we didn't talk about. We'll save them for next time. But for now, I think there's some really interesting things there that, you know, when you look at this market, that it is continually developing with new things. Even if the adoption into the enterprise isn't super fast, we do see a lot of new stuff. And it's keeping you in a job, Chris.
This is very good news for me, I tell you, especially in these days of pandemic-infused isolation.
Pandemic-infused isolation. There we go. Maybe that's the title for the podcast. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, guys. Well, thanks for your time. Great conversation, and catch up soon.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.